All right, everybody. Hello, and welcome back to another episode of In Liberty and Health. And there is a lot going on in the world, and I'm very, very excited for today's show. I'm surprised I haven't heard of my guest today's show much, much sooner, considering the fact that we have a lot of mutual friends together. And I just watched so much of her content in the last like 2-3 weeks. She does a show, I think it's every other week, with somebody who's been on the show before, Nick Cruz. Really, really like Nick. And when I first heard them together, I'm like, okay, this is a pretty cool duo. So once I went over to her channel and just started scrolling through, I saw that we cover a lot of the same topics. So I figured, especially with all the news recently, there's a lot for us to talk about. So before we get into today's conversation, please make sure you go to all the links below where you can find my guests, where you can support her, her work, all that good stuff. And then, of course, Tiger Fitness through the links below to get yourself some supplements, to get you all jacked and tan, the stuff that I use every single day. I am using another company's branched chain amino acids right now, but I'm sure that you could get, I think they're running the deal again where you can get 3 for like $40, which is a pretty damn good deal. And then lots of new like pre-workouts and stuff. I think lots of canned energy drinks as well. So all your stuff down through Tiger Fitness, use code Kyle at checkout. The alumni I sent you, Fox & Sons Coffee, use code Kyle at checkout and deemed fit through the link below. And with all of the shilling and all that stuff out of the way, let's get into today's show.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
And welcoming to the show, Sarah from DD Geopolitics. How are you?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Excellent. No, it is absolutely my pleasure. And as I told you on and now, well, off and now on air, I've just been watch a ton of your content and I really love your perspective. So why don't you let my audience know who you are and kind of where your perspective is coming from?
My name is Sarah Bills. I am one of the co-founders at DD Geopolitics. We've been a media collective for about, we're 3 years now. We've been a media collective for 3 years. I served in the military, in the United States military for 13 years and honorably retired in 2022. I think a lot of my perspective comes from being in the military and not agreeing with what was going on. Yeah, we got started because of the SMO is why what really drove me. I have a Slavic lineage. My father's Polish and Russian. And so I decided to start heavily reporting on that. And it just kind of grew from there into it grew pretty organically into what we see and have today. One major setback, a few minor setbacks, but we're still here, still doing what we do.
No,
there's about
I understand.
20, 25 of us at any given time across the world, all contributing. So it's a good thing.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I recall you saying at one point that you had been heavily doxxed for being basically pro-Russian, which is just so fascinating to me because the areas that I kind of take most interest in the geopolitical kind of stage here is China, Russia, Iran, and basically, you know, the axis of evil, as it's been dubbed more recently. And, you know, obviously all the countries that the U.S. empire is kind of targeting primarily. So my understanding is, and from what I've heard you talk about a lot, is basically like your perspective is a lot, or you kind of dig into a lot of like the Russia, Ukraine, and that kind of block of the world.
Well, I think that Russia, Ukraine really blew the gates open in terms of accessibility and media and reporting and what journalism is and how analysts can gather information and who has access to OSINT. Mm-hmm. So I think that that was the game changer, honestly. It was Telegram and the Russian special military operation that blew everything out of the water in terms of getting us like frontline access to things that we've never had access to before. So it pulled a lot of the veils down. And I think that that was a really encouraging time. I did get doxxed and framed, and a lot of horrible things happened because of my political views. But at the same time, I'd probably do it again because I did what I thought was right, and I did it with the most integrity that I thought I could. So I'm fine with what happened. But the thing that really sucks is that we were around when it wasn't so cool or so acceptable to be pro-Russian. So now, you know, after all of the censorship and the harassment and the like subjugation, we're not as popular as some of the people that are jumping on the Russia bandwagon after, say, Trump gets inaugurated. So, so it can be a little bit frustrating, but yeah, I wouldn't change it. I don't regret it.
Yeah, you know, I share a lot of that frustration because I remember during the early days of 2020, I have a status on Facebook, and this is before I even started my platform or anything. And I've been running this show since about, October of 2021. And I remember I have a status in Facebook of, I think it was March 6th of 2020. So before the United States even entered lockdowns, and I said, I'm not scared of the coronavirus. And then like, it's like 2023 and people are like, oh my God, lockdowns are stupid. I'm like, and then, you know, they get all the attention in the world. And, you know, I know you had a really, really good thread on this as well that I think you just quote tweeted before we hopped on here about like this mainstream alternative media where all these podcasters are oftentimes very, very late to the punch, like your Tim Cast, your Jack Posobiec, these huge follower accounts on Twitter that usually have dog shit takes, if I'm being honest, and they usually end up serving the CIA. That's why I kind of joked like this last election was basically like the FBI and the Justice Department versus like the CIA, yeah. And like, you know, the PayPal mafia.
Yeah.
That's literally the way the last election was. But, you know, all these guys who are getting front seats to the White House now, they're like just total controlled opposition peddling CIA narratives about China. While they may pay a little bit of lip service to like the Ukraine war stuff, but still they kind of peddle those CIA narratives.
They approach the Russia-Ukraine stuff from a very strange angle anyway. It was sort of like this nostalgic, romanticized, like we're European, like, we should stand with white like rights or whatever it was. It was like Russia's a bastion of like ethno-nationalism, like a very weird misunderstanding of Russia anyway. So, but yes, it's interesting because those are the people that have spent the last, including and all the way up to the executive branch, have spent the last decade discrediting mainstream media to get themselves in the seat. And they're just all shills for something.
Yes.
It's insane. It's really, really insane. And it's funny because I read mostly mainstream media. I don't espouse their talking points, but that's literally where I get like my initial news from. And then I go from there. I don't listen to these people at all. They don't have any analysis. They don't have any insight. They don't have, they're not connecting any of the dots. It's just, it's weird. It's like they're saying what they're allowed to say way late.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree. It's kind of like I saw Charlie Kirk coming out against the speech bill for Israel that was proposed by Mike Lawler. And it's kind of like, dude, where were you? Like back in 2017, Texans had to sign a pledge that they wouldn't criticize Israel in order to receive relief. 38 states have anti-BDS laws. I beat this stuff to death on the podcast because like nobody's talking about the fact that like Israel controls what we can and can't say in this country. And the Trump administration is going right along with it. But then you have these fools kind of like we're talking about that just go right along with it. And then like now, this speech bill is bad. Well, where were you when Trump passed the executive order, you know, combating anti-Semitism? And then, you know, there were definitely persecutions of anti-Israel boycotts under Joe Biden as well. It's not like this is a one-sided thing. It's like a very, very big continuity of policy. And I think a lot of people miss that for a lot of culture war stuff, which I'm more, you know, right-leaning overall, especially culturally. But like, I could still see, you know, the bullshit for what it is.
Well, yeah, and I also think they approach it from the wrong angle. They're like, oh, we're upset about it because of free speech. And yeah, like, I get it. Like, that is what we're upset about. But we're in a post-constitutional, like, society right now. Nobody gives a shit about whether something is against the First Amendment. They really don't care. So it was a weird angle. And I'm like, why aren't you guys connecting the dots to while we're trying to deport students for speaking their minds on the, we're protesting against Israel on their campuses. Yeah. We're also privatizing prisons in Rwanda and El Salvador, and we've already sent deportees to Gitmo. So it's like, that's the story. It's not about like, oh, ooh, like our free speech is being impeded. It's been being impeded for ever since like the dawn of time. So like, that's not even the story. The story is what they're setting up for later. It's this neoliberal reactionary government that's backsliding into totalitarianism, or I hate to say fascism because it's so like, I use it correctly, and so many people use it as like a hysteria thing, but they are backsliding into a little bit of fascistic authoritarian actions. And that's the story. The story is the regime being willing to do these things as they're recognizing that their hold on power is lessening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the things that frustrates me the most about a lot of these people too, whenever we're talking about like these specific issues, is like, you don't ever consider that this will be turned around on you. Like I argue with people all the time about this. Like, oh yeah, they're just using these speech laws to deport people. And I'm like, okay, yeah. I mean, like, I'm in favor of deportations as well, because I do think that it'll improve the living conditions of Americans here. But like, the way that they're going about it, by just focusing on punishing people for criticizing a foreign government from the perspective of people who are America first, when there have already been Americans that have been persecuted for speech against Israel, like, how could you just be indifferent about this? Like, you can't just say, oh, well, you know, yeah, we should just shouldn't fund Israel. I don't care about the Israel issue that much. Okay, well, the problem is the Israel issue cares about you.
Well, we've become more individualistic than ever. We've been talking about this a lot in my spaces on Twitter. We've been talking a lot about dark enlightenment kind of ethics, and like this amorality of this sort of anarcho-capitalist ideology. And it's a very Thiel-ish and Muskovite, I don't know what to call them, but it's a very like, it's very ideal to them, this sort of social Darwinistic. So if it doesn't affect me, it doesn't matter to me. Why should these things matter to me if they're not affecting me? If I'm overcoming them, or they're not impeding my way to get money or clout, then I don't really need to worry about them. And exactly what you said before, they don't have the foresight, or they don't have the pragmatism to say, they're just going to turn this around and use it on me when it's time. But they don't care right now.
Yeah, because right now it's being used on people that are generally... Yeah, exactly. People that they don't like.
That was the argument every time when we said, you know, it is about free speech. And if you were a real conservative, you would care about the Constitution. Yeah. That was the conversation I had with some conservatives. And a lot of their reaction was, we don't care. We don't want these people don't belong here anyway. It was just get them out by any means possible. It wasn't even really about what they were saying. So that's how they kind of get you to go along with things, right? We're doing mass deportations of the illegals that came in from the southern border, and everybody's rah, rah, rah. And in the midst of all of that, we're also persecuting these visa holders, and people, it's all just in the kerfuffle of, and people are like, well, oh yeah, them too. Get rid of them too. They're not supposed to be here.
Yeah, there's a friend of mine who's not really into politics as much as perhaps you or I are, said 2025 is going to be the year of the rug pull. And I've been thinking about that a lot today, and specifically Trump in particular. And one thing I wanted to talk to you about was this minerals deal. So let's kind of go back to Trump's history with Russia and Ukraine. I did a whole podcast on this. Yeah. Bruce in the comments. Yeah. And paying them to leave, using American taxpayer dollars to get rid of them, which is just, you know, we're supposed to be the party of financial conservatives, and we're trying to improve the economy, but we're going to, you know, basically print away your purchasing power to send people away. Trump, when he was president the first time, he got along with Putin, but I think a lot of people miss the fact that, like, he was also very, very hawkish on Russia. He was the one who sent in the Javelin anti-tank missiles that Obama wouldn't send in, you know, kicked out Russian diplomats, tore up INF treaties, all sorts of different things that actually ramped up a lot of tension with Russia. And when people, you know, just applauded him when he said, oh, this would have never happened under me, I'm like, well, you guys ignored 4 years. Yeah, 4 years of like standing policy that Trump enacted. So, and then, you know, he says, oh, as president, initially it was, yeah, on the war in 24 hours. And then he started saying, I'll end it as president-elect. Well, here we are. What is it? 105 days later. And I called it, and me and Carl Zaw had talked about this. We both kind of agreed, like, this is probably going to end up being like a frozen conflict on Trump's watch. That kind of seems to be
pushing for that. They've actually asked for that today.
Yeah. So go ahead. Your thoughts on kind of Trump and how this has all played out.
I'm really disappointed in Trump. I mean, I'm not a Trumper. I'm not MAGA.
Sure.
But I don't dislike Trump at all. I actually find him quite endearing personally, but politically, this is a mess. This is such a mess. This is such a huge stain on MAGA. This was there. I mean, there are so many we could talk about, but I think this is the biggest one. This inability to even understand the conflict, let alone solve it. And an admin of mine, our Russian female admin, she's in Siberia. She wrote a letter or wrote an essay about how the Russians are just using these talks and all of the blustering by the Americans as a way to just make the Americans look stupid. They're literally just standing by while we look dumb. We keep flying back and forth to do peace talks, and Russia keeps saying the same thing. The goals haven't changed since the beginning of the SMO. Like, we don't have to have these talks. So much so that we pulled out of the talks. I think it was on Tuesday or Thursday of last week. We pulled out of the talks completely. This has been a huge, I think they should be very embarrassed of this. The way that they went in, the hubris and the arrogance that they were going to solve this. A conflict that has been centuries in the making, that we've fomented since 1948. It just tells me that you don't have any idea of your own foreign policy, your own country's history. You don't understand anything. You don't understand. Did he even read the grand chessboard? Like, I'm not sure. So I think that it's really been abysmal. That's been my biggest disappointment in Trump. Not that I think that he was going to solve it anyway, but just the way that they've tried to go about it shows a total lack of diplomacy. If you look through the mineral deal, it's the Iraq deal again. It's just for privatization and opening up the markets to opening up the natural resource markets to American companies. American companies get precedent. They get preferential treatment on all contracts. It's bad. It's bad for everybody. It's really not even that great for the United States either. And I believe it was Kellogg today who said that I believe he even said the word frozen. Russia's never going to go for that. This conflict has been frozen for a very long time, and it's been simmering, I guess you would say, on the back burner, and Russia's never going to go for that. Minsk 1 and Minsk 2 both froze the conflict that was inevitable. Russia's never going to go for that again. Never.
Yeah. Now, I remember when Trump was doing the whole dress down to Zelensky, and the Americans and everybody kind of went rah-rah about it. But I think the major thing that a lot of people missed in there was Trump saying, oh, yeah, we'll give you pretty much everything you want. Security guarantees, peacekeeping deployments, more weapons, more aid, pretty much everything that Joe Biden was willing to do, and then some. But then it was J.D. Vance that kind of stepped in and, kind of rebuked Zelensky and said, have you been grateful at all? But, it seemed like Trump was really just like, how do you think you're going to end the war by doing all the same stuff that Biden did, but trying to apply tariffs? Like, it didn't make any sense to me. And people were like, oh, yeah, he's bringing Putin to the table. I'm like, how is he going to do this? Because Trump has nothing. Ukraine has nothing. The only way that you could really get the war to end is basically just, and Trump, I think, could do this, is just say, hey, this is Biden's war. He fucked up. I'm cleaning my hands of it. Zelensky, good luck. But, we want good relations with Russia. We have to walk away from this because we just can't do this anymore. But instead, it seems like he's really digging his heels in and just doesn't want to be embarrassed from a promise that he made on the campaign.
He could have ended the war probably by just forcing them to have an election.
Yeah.
He probably could have ended the war just by saying, you know what, I'm not going to support your claim to suspend your constitution. You have to have an election in order to continue to have military aid. Yeah. That would have been the end of the war, but they don't want to end the war. That's the thing. They don't want to end the war. This recent mineral deal and the 50 million arm permission thing that came right after that deal, both have opened up the floodgates to these companies, to the forever war lobbyists. The forever war lobbyists are not your mom and dad's MIC. It's not Lockheed Martin and Boeing and Northrop Grumman. It's not them. They're still around. It's OpenAI, it's X, it's Palantir, it's Anduril, it's all of these strange AI companies that like partner with drone and private weapons manufacturers. It's even people like Eric Prince that want these wars to continue. Stephen Miller wants these wars to continue, not because of anything ideological, but because they're the forever war lobby, and they need, especially the PayPal mafia, they need these wars for data collection and defense supremacy.
Yeah. So one kind of curious thing there, and maybe this is a little bit of a side tangent, but I'm curious your thoughts on this. I want to say you probably changed my mind a little bit on this, because initially I was always of the mind that, like, you have a couple different influences on Trump, right? You have the neoconservative lobby, your Frank Gaffney, your Lindsey Graham, your Howard Lutnick, those kind of guys who are just like dyed-in-the-wool neoconservative Zionists, right? They're a pretty big, you know, influence on Trump. Then obviously they have some overlap with the Zionist lobby, your Meir Madelson. And then you have your PayPal mafia, your Vivek Ramaswamy, Eric Prince, and the people that you had mentioned. In my mind, and like I said, I think you're responsible for changing my mind a little bit on this. It seemed like the PayPal mafia was probably the best influence. Now, I'm not saying a good influence, but the best influence on Trump, because in my mind, it kind of seemed like, oh, these are just business guys. War, it doesn't make them money, so they're going to want to pull away from this. But now you're saying otherwise, that, like, hey, they kind of want to use this for AI stuff. And this kind of goes into the bigger picture here, where we look at the national defense strategies, and then obviously Obama's pivot to Asia that Trump was a big part in, where, like, they want to have all this AI for basically like drones and stuff like that, where Biden was drawing up plans to have a giant drone swarm to rain down on China. China is developing drones as well. So, like, I think this kind of contributes to this whole big picture here. So I know that's kind of like all over the place, but your thoughts on all that?
Well, he's more beholden to the PayPal mafia, and they're way more dangerous than the neocons. At least the neocons operate on some sort of moral code, right? Like,
yeah.
Like they you kind of understand how they're going to react. These guys are completely amoral. So what we talk about often on my stream on the Sunday show is the that actual like whole network. We talk about that frequently. So these people are all in cahoots and like multinational business deals, which incorporate Israel, El Salvador, Ecuador, Honduras now. And they want to get into Ukraine. So this deal, the one that the $50 million deal, also opened up for the UK to do a $50 million drone deal with Ukraine, which supplies Anduril, which is a company that was training their drones in Gaza. So Ukraine is getting the drones that the IDF trained with the intelligence that IDF trained. So all this stuff comes full circle. Yeah. Anduril is a partner of Palantir. Anduril and Palantir are in a partnership to try to convince OpenAI and SpaceX to join them in a new military industrial complex venture company where they make satellite-based air defense systems and weapon systems. Yeah. It's terrifying because they're doing this. They're so rich. They have so much. They have more money than some countries, and they're just operating very freely because they operate in this weird crypto universe that doesn't really have many regulations. Oh, Eric Prince is involved as well. I mean, the Palantir is helping to train. And let's be honest, like Bukele's, those aren't like hyper trained police forces. They're literally death squads trained by the IDF with software from Palantir. And Google's down there running their cloud. And Blackwater wants to go down there and open private prisons. So it's like one thing on top of another. And when they say, I'm going to go to Ukraine and we're going to open the door for private investments, and I hear contract with Anduril, I'm like, oh, well, that just connects them right into the Israeli the deportation network. So it's like, it's all one big cluster F. And Trump's way more beholden to them. They've given over, I think, $300 million to his campaign. And that's just Elon and Peter Thiel and David Sachs alone.
Yeah. Holy crap. Was that a program that you're referring to? Is that Where's Daddy AI that Israel had dubbed it, I think it was?
I think they were involved with that, as well as Clearview and Lavender.
Holy crap. Yeah, I didn't know that they were actually using that in Ukraine as well.
They are going to start. Yeah. So, okay. I mean, Ukraine was very much used as a weapons testing ground. Sure. And then Gaza was, the AI went really crazy in Gaza. That was really, really pushed as an AI training ground.
Mm. That's absolutely insane. When I heard this minerals deal, I saw some people supporting it saying, oh, we have to kind of recoup our money from this. And like, oh, you know, this mindset where we got to get something back from Ukraine. I'm like, I don't understand how getting any more involved in Ukraine is going to either end this conflict or be good for the American people. Because I remember hearing Trump talk about this on the campaign trail. And when he finally got pressed on how he would end the war, I remember him saying something to the degree of, I'll tell Russia that I'm going to give Ukraine more than they've ever gotten. And I'm going to tell Ukraine, basically strategic ambiguity, where like, you don't know what we'll do, so you better not fuck around. You won't find out. The same thing that they're basically trying to do with Taiwan and China. But, you know, like I said, in my mind, I'm just like, but Russia has the cards and Russia can throw enough people at the problem that they're not really worried about it. Ukraine's only so big. So eventually they're going to run out of people, especially when you think about like the Battle of Bakhmut. What was that in like 2023, where the average life expectancy of a soldier was like 4 hours. How do you expect this to go when, once again, Ukraine and America has no leverage over Russia and they could afford to lose people, and they're really not losing that many people compared to Ukraine?
Well, they're getting to a crossroads where they have to decide, and that's where you're seeing these odd, like, irrational statements from like Germany and the UK, like, we're gonna fight. Because the United States is coming to a crossroads too. I'm sorry, I can't recall her name, but the same woman that announced that we would be removing ourselves from the peace talks or the mediating position, also said we have other places. There's other places in the world that really need our attention. They're very tired of Ukraine. Ukraine is a Democrat business endeavor. That was a Victoria Nuland project. Yep. That whole squad. McCain, Kerry, the Clintons, all of them. Ukraine is their project. Burisma is a Democrat enrichment company. The Republicans aren't really involved in Burisma. They don't really care about that. They have business interests elsewhere. India, China, some of them are in Eastern Europe, and a great deal of them are in Latin and South America. They don't want to do this anymore. It's a money sink. I think that Joe Biden kind of locked himself in there because of, you know, whatever business dealings he had in Ukraine, as well as his son and Victoria Nuland as well. But Trump's not locked down by that. He's not threatened by that. So I think that Trump will have to make a decision very soon in order to save face. But I think that the only thing that he can do is to walk away, because Putin's not, especially after this weekend, people forget in 2 days is the 80th anniversary of the victory in the Great Patriotic War, which is a huge deal in Russia. And he's talking to all of the world leaders in person. So Trump has to make a decision soon. Russia's not going to stop. Not on someone else's terms.
So 2 days will be, what will that be, Saturday?
It's on Friday, the 9th, May 9th, every year.
Okay, so everybody, make sure you go check out Sarah's show, because I'm sure you'll cover
it. Oh, I won't be on Friday, but okay. I'll be streaming on Sunday. So there will be wheeling and dealing there. They've said multiple times, like I said earlier, the goals have not changed in the SMO, and they won't. So unless they're going to guarantee no NATO and neutrality and a total denazification to the liking of Russia, they're not going to see peace. And that's just... something that I don't think that the Americans really can grasp.
Yeah. So one thing I wanted to talk to you about as well, and you had mentioned it a little bit there, was a Putin meeting with world leaders, and specifically BRICS. So it's been very interesting to me, and I'm trying to learn everything I can from everybody. So when you listen to like the Zihans of the world, the Peter Zihans, basically it's like, oh, China's doomed, and the BRICS is like nothing. But I'm thinking this whole tariff situation, specifically this trade war with China, is really going to test the strength of BRICS. And if, in my opinion, which, you know, could be very, very, you know, much so better informed, I think they're going to be okay, because basically this is testing if China needs access to dollars. So with these tariffs, and we're basically, you know, pulling Americans away from purchasing Chinese goods, then now we're going to see if China and these other economies are going to be okay trading everywhere else. I think they're going to be fine, because basically, you know, it's not the same world it was 15 years ago where everybody says, oh, cheap Chinese junk. Well, no, they're building advanced technology and they're improving. They're doing what I think the U.S. should be doing, and that's encouraging free trade and peace around the world instead of bombing the shit out of everybody and slaughtering people. So what do you think with BRICS and kind of this whole trade war? Do you think that Trump is basically emboldening BRICS, or do you think BRICS is going to fall apart as soon as they don't have access to dollars anymore?
BRICS will be fine, but I don't think that the tariffs are a direct challenge to BRICS, although they did encourage Xi to get out of his comfort zone and go out into Southeast Asia. So if anything, the tariff debacle was kind of a kick in the ass for global South countries. Xi went and traveled all over South Asia, namely and especially Vietnam. Now, the Trumps have a huge, huge business deal in Vietnam that's potentially passing through, depending on the tariff situation. Well, Xi went down there and said, well, I'll give you a high-speed rail. So Vietnam's getting a high-speed rail before Elon could give us one in California. Like, let that sink in. Yeah. So this kind of stuff, this is the stuff that these global South countries look for. They look for infrastructure. They don't want a Trump golf course. They want high-speed rail connecting to Malaysia and China. That's what they're doing, a whole entire network that's connecting all the Southeastern countries. So this is actually a motivator to strengthen BRICS ties. I don't think BRICS will collapse. It's not even built that way that it would collapse. It's not organized in such a way that it would. That's a good thing and a bad thing for BRICS. It lacks a lot of infrastructure. So in terms of if something awful.
There's not like an Article 5 like NATO.
Exactly. There's nothing like that. It's only an economic bloc. And even that, there's not any infrastructure like that or reassurances or any economical security guarantees, anything like that. They just, you know, it's an oath that they will trade with each other with no sanction restrictions. They won't honor any sanctions put in place by the West, et cetera. And it works. And I think people put, especially in the West, they've kind of built it up to be something that it's not. So then they are also like praying for its downfall. It's like, well, it's not as big as you said it was. So it's not really, it's not in a place to really fail. It's just a forum.
Yeah. Yeah. And I kind of thought about, people would ask me like, oh, do you think World War III is going to break out if, you know, basically Israel pops off, you know, fighting a war against Iran? I'm like, no, because like, I think people assume that like, because Iran has a good relationship with Russia, that automatically means that Russia is going to come to Iran's defense. I'm like, I don't think it's necessarily that straightforward. Like kind of like we're saying here, where it's like BRICS is a trading, you know, partnership. It's not necessarily like a military agreement. So just because they have a good relationship doesn't mean that they're going to militarily defend one another. Now, could they? Sure. But like, that doesn't seem to me to be in Putin's interest to go fight a war against Israel in defense of Iran. But, you know, if you think otherwise.
No, absolutely not. They even have a defensive partnership, a strategic agreement between Russia and Iran that was recently ratified. And that still wouldn't, there's not going to go to war for Iran against Israel. I think that the Israelis, just to even mitigate that even being a possibility, are making a lot of overtures to the Russians, but that's not in Russia's interest. Russia doesn't want people getting involved in the Ukraine war. Why would they go get involved in somebody else's like existential war? It's just not this. And like we've already been talking about the uncertainty of the Russia-Ukraine war and how important that is and how many lives they already have lost. They're not going to give more to Iran. They'll supply them with weapons maybe, but that's already in an agreement.
Yeah. To me, it never made a lot of sense that like World War III is going to pop off if, you know, all of a sudden the US gets into it with Iran. Now, like, could you say, hey, maybe it's like a cascading event? Okay, maybe. But sure. To me, it just doesn't seem necessarily, you know, from point A to point B. The other thing I wanted to discuss a little bit was kind of like the global South and also like the Latin America countries. It's so bizarre to me because in my mind, I see like a clear path for Trump to do a lot of great things, but he just doesn't. Like tariffs, okay, that's not going to help. Being very, very bad to Latin American countries and, you know, sanctioning the fuck out of them. You know, like they had talks with, not Maduro. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, it was Maduro. And then they stole a bunch of his helicopters. And then the global South countries, you know, they're sanctioning them and, you know, pulling relief and stuff like that. Whereas, you know, China goes in with a briefcase. We go in with bombs. So I guess let's kind of start with Latin America. Like I said, to me, it just seems like, hey, Venezuela, we'll lift all sanctions off you. We want some energy from you because you have a ton of oil underneath your feet. Let's have a great relationship so that way you don't partner up with China. But instead, we're going to try to coup you again. Elon's going to get into a fist fight with Nicolas Maduro, all this stupid stuff. Trump could be the guy to pull this off, but he just has too many retards around him.
there is this, they really think that Maduro is like pure communism and that like if they allow him to stay, it's going to permeate out. It's this weird like old Nixon Kissinger sort of mentality. Plus you have Marco Rubio as a sex state, and he's as the sex state, he he's a hawk regardless, but he is a hawk on Latin South America. He even said it before he got in about basically here I come. So that's in place. It has a lot to do with the oil and the way that Maduro wants to allow them or not allow them to access it, and the nationalization of natural resources. This happens in every Latin America. It's like rinse and repeat. They nationalize resources. We coup the president. We run, put the country in ruins. We privatize everything. Rinse and repeat. It happens in every single one. And we just haven't been successful in couping Maduro. We have been successful in sanctioning them into oblivion and then trying to make it into like a human rights issue where we've sanctioned you to now you're starving. And now we're saying Maduro's a dictator who's starving his people. And we've tried to coup them. And even the stuff that we've been pushing lately, it just recently came out yesterday, is that Tren de Agua, or whatever that gang name is that they blame everything on, the CIA just released a report that says that Venezuela is not responsible for them at all. They're not pushing them. It says that they're not sponsoring them. They're persecuting them when they can. And though the state is a permissible environment for these sorts of things, there's no proof or no truth in the statement that Venezuela or Maduro is telling Tren de Agua to come to the United States. And it's like, we don't need to do, like, we shouldn't have to do this. Like, we could just be normal. We can engage in BRICS. Rubio said that the multipolar world was coming. He knows. It's this weird, like, we're going to have to pull you in kicking and screaming while you destroy everything in your path as we get there kind of thing. It's very strange. And I expect them to continue to try to coup Maduro. They're having parliamentarian elections at the end of the month. So we'll see how they go, but.
Okay, they had Maria Corina Machado, I think her name is, running again in this last election. And like you said, I could totally see them going for another coup after the failed one, specifically with Marco Rubio and Trump in 2020 with Operation Gideon, where they sent four Americans down there. It failed. And, you know, Maduro still stood. And like my understanding of their elections, I had Anya Parampel on probably about a year ago.
Oh, she's fantastic.
Yes, she is. And we talked about this a little bit where it's like their elections are actually pretty damn good. And like this last election, if I remember correctly, it was like 80% of the votes were in. It was clear Maduro won. But then, of course, everybody's like, oh, no, we can't have a socialist down there. Okay, right. Well, why don't you stop emboldening him? Like, if socialism is so bad, which, you know, I would tend to agree it is, then like, why don't you just let it, you know, win or lose in the marketplace of ideals? If it's so bad, let it fail. But if for some reason, they're so determined to just sanction this country into oblivion and try to commit a coup on it. Like, once again, if it's going to fail on its merits, it will.
Right. Well, they're only worried about their bottom line. And and the nationalization of natural resources really hits their pockets really hard. If those things don't belong to people, we need to buy up the lithium deposits for Elon Musk's electric car venture, whatever the hell it is. Yeah. So, I mean, it's about natural resources and keeping them subjugated. They also give us cheap labor. You think that they really want to deport all these people? You think that they really want to stop people from coming in? If they did, they would make sure that these countries were stabilized and they'd stop couping them and arming death squads to terrorize people. They don't care about that. They care about their bottom line. And the only reason that they're doing this sort of Latin American safari sort of we're going to clean up is to put more money in the pockets of their private corporatist buddies. Yeah. So everything is a show.
Yeah. So what do you think is kind of going on with the global South? So we're talking like over in Africa and over there. So this has been very interesting because, you know, it's been underdeveloped for so long, but though China, as it's, I don't even want to say expanding, because I feel like that's not the right word. Because I think when people think expanding, they think it's like you're taking over this country. I have a friend, Tommy, very, very good friend of mine, who his wife's from Africa and he goes over to Namibia. And I remember him and I were talking. He's like, I don't get more hawkish on China, but I get more concerned every single time I go over there. But, you know, the other thing that people talk about with China is like, oh, we don't want them having AI. It's like, okay, well, are you so sure that like the U.S.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs,
plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Us is going to be a better influence because who's killed, you know, millions of people over the last 25 years? It isn't China. China hasn't fought a war in almost like 50 years. So, like, I don't understand the argument here. And it seems like China's generally taking care of, you know, Africa. You know, they're giving them infrastructure, like you said, high-speed rail. They're giving them low-interest loans, sometimes even just forgiving the loans. So, like, if you want access to that area, to me, it seems clear, but for some reason, everybody in Washington can't seem to think beyond their own ass.
I don't understand that part of it either. It's like this weird, like, why don't you just, it's like, he's not that into you. Like, when do you just get the hint? They don't want our type of democracy. Our type of governing and our type of culture doesn't work in societies like this. These societies are much more communal. They're much more egalitarian. They work more together. We are a very individualistic society. So it doesn't make sense that our culture and our democracy, quote unquote, would work and be welcomed in places in the global South. That doesn't even make sense. And I don't know why they can't really wrap their minds around that. You know, if you leave these people alone and you kind of let them govern, if they would have left Thomas Sankara, who was the leader of Burkina Faso, when they had gotten their independence, you just leave people like that and work with them. You're probably in a better position than if you keep arming them and encouraging child soldiers and warlords. The things that are happening in Africa are astounding. They're really only happening in the Sahel and Western Africa. But what we're seeing is a sort of not in a hokey sense either. I hate to like say it like this, but this sort of decolonization, an actual decolonization, not of the mind or of the academics, but like, get the hell out, France. Like, we don't want your money either. And I think that somebody just went to Ibrahim Traore, the leader of Burkina Faso.
Okay, I'm glad you touched on that. Yeah,
with an offer for, and I can't remember what it was for. I think it was some sort of mining. And he said, no, if you want to build mines, you have to build schools and hospitals too. And the people refused. And he was like, okay, then I don't want it. And that's just, that's all that needs to be done. Just show the example. I think it was a leader in Kenya that said, every time China comes, we get a hospital. Every time the British come, we get a lecture. So they don't want to work with us anymore. Like, that's the end of the road. The abusive relationship is finally over. And we're the abusive partner. Like, I can't believe he finally left us.
Yeah. Like, it's so crazy to me because, like, I am a EV technician and like a fan of EVs. Like, literally today we just drove. I work for a Cadillac dealership and we got one of the new Vestiques. So it's like a Cadillac SUV that's all electric. And this thing is fucking fast. They're fucking awesome. If I could afford a brand new EV Hummer, it would be sitting in my driveway right now, but they're like $130,000 and I don't make that much money as much as I wish I do. So, like, you know, just as well as I do, that all these resources are in Africa. And like you said, if we want access to these, I would love to see more people in Teslas and the infrastructure be there for EVs and have even BYDs over here that they have in China. Because I talked to, I'm pretty sure, our mutual friend, Nico House, and he was all about the BYDs. I'm like, man, I'd love to see them over here. He's like, yeah, for like $36,000, you can get like a loaded BYD with better range than any of the GMs and the Teslas.
Yeah, when I was in Russia, all the chauffeurs had Chinese electric cars. They were fantastic. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome technology. Like I said, I'm a huge fan of these things. But like, why don't we foster relationships around the world that will bring us that prosperity that we want for, you know, these EVs? Because like I said, I'd love to see the you know, the infrastructure here for it, but it's just not there and they're not affordable. Like all the ones that I work on, they're at minimum like $70,000, which for the average working class person, they'll look at that like, you want me to pay like $1,000 a month for a vehicle? No, I can't do that.
Most of us can't. You know, most Americans can't. And that's where we're kind of getting to our breaking point, where it's like the consumer, we're a consumer-based society, we're a service-based economy, and the people that would normally purchase the services and consume the products can't afford them.
Yeah.
So it's like, we're getting to that sort of breaking point. And that's also what drove a lot of the the wars and aggression against the global South was keeping these sorts of things affordable. Well, China is showing that they could keep them affordable and still make them at a huge scale. And whether we agree with their methods or not, they're just showing that it can be done. And that's something that Americans are seeing. And they're like, well, I mean, there's Japanese electric vehicles that are only $7,000 brand new. So it's like, why can Japan, a westernized Asian country, do it? And we can't. We're supposed to be the best country in the world. I think that China has shown us a lot. China's become sort of a mirror.
Yeah. I have a friend, Connor Freeman, who writes for antiwar.com. He's just absolutely fantastic. And he said on Judge Napolitano's show that the last vestiges of American exceptionalism went up in flames with Aaron Bushnell whenever he decided to, you know, do what he did. And I really think that's true, because like when you look at China, I talked to Jason Smith. He's been on the show a couple times. And I remember him saying, yeah, I could get like a gas powered Mercedes for like $7,000 over here. And I'm like, the Cobalt sitting in my driveway that's 15 years old, it cost me like $4,800 to get that. My wife's Terrain that we have, that's now almost 10 years old. We paid on that for 6 years. That was almost $30,000. And like, you know, my wife and I, we're not rich, but we're definitely not poor. We live pretty damn good. You know, we're gonna have our first kid here in a few months.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. And like, we're gonna be fine, but like, it's not like we have piles of money sitting around. I wish we did, but you know, people over in China, oh, you need a back surgery, all right, that'll be a couple bucks, and you can stay in the hospital, you know, it'll be like 50-60 bucks and you'll be out, you know, in a couple days. Whereas here, you know, my wife's an EMT and everybody goes through emergency because our healthcare sucks. Our mutual friend Misty Winston was just saying she finally got a dentist that like settled down with her daughter and they connected, and her daughter loved this dentist. And now guess what? Healthcare is fucked. She has to go get a new dentist and go through this process all over again. And yeah, apparently you have a fan in the chat, another live Sarah's machine. Yeah,
I've done quite a few.
Okay. Yeah. Apparently you got a few fans. So sorry. Go ahead.
It's okay. Well, yeah. And I think that, you know, that's it's kind of a part of a liberal dichotomy where the enemy is very strong. And they're also very weak at the same time. They're so good that they're beating us, and they're so awful that they're like too stupid to be like us. It's a very interesting thing. China is a place that the motto is the people are the party, and the party is the people, and the party is what runs the country. So if the people are the party, then in theory, the policy should reflect that. I mean, we're talking about 95% home ownership in China. Yeah, that's insane to even think about.
I think about the generations that are coming up. So I just turned 30 back in November. So I'll be 31 this year. And I've lived in this house for about 8 years, but like the people who are 10 years younger than me, like, you guys will never own a house. Like I feel bad for you guys. Pennsylvania, which is where I live, very cheap to live here. But I look around the rest of the country, we were contemplating moving to Florida, and I'm like, how the fuck is somebody going to afford this right out of college? House $200,000. Your mortgage is $1,500 a month. You got student loans. Okay. So right there between your student loans and your house payment, we're talking just the mortgage and your student loans, almost $2,000 a month.
Easily.
Yeah. Who can afford that?
Nobody. Yeah. And that, I think that's you brought up student loans, and I'm a big anti-student loan person. I think that everybody should have access to higher education. Maybe that's liberal, I don't know, but that's something that's very much promoted in other countries, especially in China. They are encouraged to go to school. They have one of the highest IQs. I think they have the highest in the world now.
Yeah.
This is very much encouraged. Everybody can afford it. It's free. They have lotteries. Yes. So you can get into like your preferential schools, and mm-hmm. and they're done on whatever basis, but same thing for Russia. There's lotteries and you get in according to, but they're not that expensive. They're very much affordable. And even in Europe, they're like that. In Germany, I remember it was very cheap. It was only like $600 a semester for Americans or something like that. So that's part of the issue. That's one of the largest problems, is that we're bringing these kids up and then we're putting them into adult life and saddling them with six figures of debt
right
off the bat, after we've been spending the last like 20, 30 years discrediting academia in totality, not because our academia sucks, but because of the people that couldn't get into it wanted to discredit it. That's what it really was. So now we have a full-on university system that's under attack. people saying that it's bad and student loans and all of that stuff. So that's one of the bedrocks of society. If we don't have an intelligentsia, if we don't have people that are of actual like intelligence, then how will we move forward?
Yeah, I'm kind of two minds on this where, you know, I believe that there should be no public student loans because, you know, the problem is that these universities just drive up the cost because they have readily available funds. And it's basically indentured servitude because you can't default on these loans. The government guarantees them. So the government shouldn't be in that business at all in this respect, because really it's just, like I said, it drives up the cost because people can't get out of it. It's the only debt you can't default on. And, you know, you're told for so long that, oh, you have to go to college. We're like, you know, I went to a trade school, but even like that was insanely expensive. You know, my stepbrother went to a really, really prestigious college around here. He went for 5 years, ended up $100,000 in debt, never graduated. But it's like, why would you tell kids to like saddle them up with all this debt? It's absolutely insane. It shouldn't be anywhere near that expensive. And especially like when your purchasing power doesn't go far enough to really justify doing that, where like, you know, the average household income, I think is like $80,000 a year. Well, $80,000 a year, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 30 years ago was good. Now it's like, okay, well, you're doing all right, but you ain't absolutely crushing it anymore. And, you know, most people ain't going to even make that when they graduate college. It's such a disaster. But, you know, I really feel for the younger generations that are looking at like socialism and these other countries where, you know, you're told this is a communist hellhole, but like what you're saying, they can go to school, you know, they're not saddled with debt. They have a home, they can afford a family. Like, okay, well, that doesn't sound too bad. So I can't blame them.
I don't think that people understand the toll that takes on collective psyche. The fact that these people are six figures in debt, the idea that one medical emergency can ruin you forever.
Yeah.
The idea that losing your job can ruin you forever. Happier countries have better social safety nets. We don't have any, and we're getting ready to take away the little that we do have. So that has a lot to do with it. People are happier in places where they're not worried about their survival. We're worried about our survival and surrounded by junk that doesn't mean anything. That's why we're so unhappy. Most places are living according to their needs and aren't afraid to break their arm. I broke my foot over the summer and I had to like make a conscientious decision about whether or not I was going to get medical care. Like that's something that people in other countries don't even have to think about.
Yeah.
So I'm not a person that's like Medicare for all, communism, but I'm just saying like these things are very stressful. Worrying about stuff like that and being around a society that has no communal values, your neighbor's not going to take care of you. They probably don't even know your name. I know mine don't. You're on your own, and your government's not going to take care of you either. You're on your own, and that's a very terrifying thing. When you're on the hierarchy of needs. If you're not having those met, you become increasingly violent, irritable, and unproductive.
Yeah, I completely agree. And like the number one reason why people aren't having families, and this is what I want, you know, I want people who obviously want to have families to feel like, hey, I can have a family. If my wife wants to stay home, she can. Nope. If she wants to work, she could do that. Like that would be great. But right now it's such a disaster that people are like, oh no, I can't afford to do that. Like, you know, if my wife has a kid right now, then like we're gonna be completely fucked. You know, childcare is gonna break us. Like you said, a medical emergency, we're done. You know, my wife with, you know, throughout this pregnancy, there's just been not like anything major, but you know, her blood pressure would go up or something like that. And you know, I kind of have to think about it like, fuck man, if she goes to the doctor, this costs a lot of money. Like, why should I have to worry about that in like a first world country where we're supposed to believe that once again, American exceptionalism, that this is so great and we have it all and all these other countries are shitholes. I just over time talking to people who live in other countries, it's like, no, we're really not that great. Maybe we once were, but not anymore.
Exactly. And that's the fact that we don't take care of one another. You know, then, and that's the issue. They address the problems right now. They're doing this whole like, everybody should start having babies. And then like all the normal people are like, how? like you're not even talking about like the actual problems about why people don't have kids. I remember after my first kid, my husband at the time asked me if I wanted to have a second. And this was a long time ago. And I was much more well off than I am now. And I looked at him and I said, we can't afford it.
Yeah.
We can't afford the daycare. Like that's, then like stuff like that. Those are things that a Chinese, even a French person doesn't have to think about. That stuff's handled. So you can have another kid. You want to bring another. If I'm unhappy, why do I want to bring a kid into this? A rational person isn't going to want to bring any children into this. And everything's kind of crumbling around us. So they just put Elon in front of us and say, well, he has 15 kids, so you should aspire to do this, but we're not addressing any of the things that prevent you from being able to.
Yeah, there's something funny to me about Elon, his whole little empire there, especially like when he starts talking about his one daughter or son, whoever it was. He said, oh, they took, you know, him, her away from me. And it's like, okay, well, I understand you're, you know, high powered executive, you're busy and you have businesses to run. Okay, I get that. But if you were more present as a father, don't you think you would feel like you failed? Like when my daughter gets here, if like she's, you know, 15 years old and runs away and starts smoking weed or doing drugs or anything like that. And not that I think these are like great moral failings, but like the first thing I would do is ask myself, where did I go wrong? Not they fucked her up. It's what did I do wrong? How did I provide my daughter with a bad enough life that she feels like she has to do these things? And like, obviously I can't control her, but once again, the onus at a certain point when you're a parent, it, at least in my opinion, I'm not a parent yet, but like the onus is on you. You do bear, you know, a large lion's share of the responsibility on your children.
That's the thing about Elon, and not to get too big into his personal life, but Elon was a liberal, right? So let me just get this dog one second.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, I can completely empathize with the dog struggles. I think they're both in the other room with my wife, but Rise of Liberty. It's easy for them to pay for healthcare when they outsource their military protection to us. I mean, that's a fair point. China doesn't necessarily do the same thing. What kind of, oh, you have a French bulldog? Yes. Oh my God. My singer and bass player raised Frenchies. That is awesome.
Elon, right. So he used to be a liberal. He's very liberal. Remember he was kind of toying with a little bit of socialism for a little while and kind of like, I remember like the left, like the Nick kind of area of the internet, like the actual like left were like, oh, this isn't that bad. I mean, this is before the Wilku, whoever we want, but even after Wilku, whoever we want, he was still espousing a lot of sort of socialist kind of ideology a little bit. He was a liberal. He switched to the other side and he started espousing like very meme lord sort of talking points, right? Yeah. He's never spent time with those kids. Those kids hate him. His ex-wife has written multiple pieces about it and done interviews about it. So exactly that. He uses that kid to kind of ingratiate himself with this right-wing culture. Right. The liberal woke mind virus got my child. I'm just like you guys. It's like, no, you're not like us at all. You're a billionaire and you weren't around for your kids. They hate your guts and you keep on making babies out of test tubes to see if you'll finally get one right. Like there's nothing normal about this. He uses that child to ingratiate himself with the sort of turf and anti-trans and anti-woke right. And it works. There's people that literally are like have said that he lost his son, like talking about it as like a death. And I'm like, you're really sick. Not that I'm like a big supporter of like kids being trans, but I'm like, this is very weird. The whole thing is just very weird. He uses his kids as props and human shields to sort of be more relatable. Look at me. I have kids. Look at me. Like, it's like very strange. It's very hokey and odd the way he totes X around. He says, my son is dead to me about the liberal woke virus killed my son. It's just, it's all an act. He doesn't care about any of this.
Yeah. I have a friend named Ryan and he always says when people throw up their kids on Twitter, whenever it comes to like an argument or something like that, he always says, fuck trophies for clout. And that's really what it is. It's just like, in my opinion, nobody will ever see a picture of my kid. Right. The podcast audience, right? Like, I'm sorry if we're friends or something like that, you see me in public or something, okay, yes, but like I'm not going to hold my daughter up to the camera for everybody to see because she's not a prop. And if she wants to do that when she's an adult, okay, that's fine, but I'm sorry, and maybe not even when she's adult because she could be my daughter, but she's not a prop for me to use as a political pawn to get across my message. That's what so many people do, especially social conservatives. They love to do this. Basically, they throw their kids up and say that, hey, if you criticize me, you're actually criticizing my child, so therefore you're a bad person. Okay, well, how about you actually make the fucking argument and you use logic and evidence and, you know, data to support what you're saying, not just throw your kids up and say you're a bad person if you disagree with me. And that's what so many people do.
Yeah, he uses X as a prop for that reason, to make him kind of be more human, make him be more relatable. I'm a good dad. I'm a nice guy. I take my kid along. The rest of the story is that I don't have anything to do with the rest of the gaggle. And this is just for show. It's exactly like what you said. Social media, people putting their kids up for like the engagement, the clout, or like the relatability, or to soften up their own image, right? Don't pick on me. I have this lovely child.
Yeah, no, my opinion is if you're on Twitter, you're pretty much fair game.
I've never put a picture of my child on Twitter, ever.
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and you know, the problem is that like people who do, I don't think they're necessarily doing it for bad reason. I think they just make the default assumption that all people are good people and they wouldn't ever do anything poor with their kids or anything like that. Like I remember there was this one dude, PDB or something like that. He was some jag off, but
the one that kept showing his daughter.
Yeah, and then
I like, oh my god, this story. I have a great story about that. We were in a group chat together, right? Okay. And this had been going on for like a week.
Okay,
I kept seeing this on my timeline. I'm like, stop talking about it. It will literally, he'll stop and it'll go away. And then I realized, oh, they're doing it. And I said to him in the group chat, he sent him one of the posts, and I was like, I'm not gonna like your post. This engagement farming with your daughter. It's weird. You keep calling your daughter ugly. Like literally, you keep reiterating, why did Tate call my daughter ugly?
Yeah. Oh, like, yeah.
I was like, I'm not gonna engage with posts that use your kids for clout. And he flipped out and like was like, you're a weirdo, blah, blah, blah. I was like, all right.
Yeah. He said, oh yeah, someone made a picture of them doing grotesque things to my daughter. And I'm like, that's wrong. Yes, but like, wouldn't you think, hey, I have 300,000 followers on Twitter or however many, and like people go on Twitter to be assholes. Let's be honest here. Like I've had all my viral posts were never like educational, me trying to teach somebody about nutrition or geopolitics or auto mechanics. None of those. You know what once went viral? When I said Russell Brand is being a doormat for neocons and Zionists. Or when I said Tim Pool, when Trump got shot at, had an erection that lasted longer than 3 hours because and he went down saying civil war. When I say dumb shit like that, it goes viral. But like the you know, informational stuff never does. So why would you put your kids in the position where you know that some people are probably following you that aren't good people? They're going to do that nefariously. So like I don't get the math there.
If you're in an argument online with Andrew Tate, regardless of Andrew Tate, understanding his audience, why would you put up pictures of your kid?
Yeah,
like have some situational awareness. That's why part of me was like, you did this on purpose. You're not a dumb guy. You have a ton of followers. You know social media and how it works. These people are really sick online. Really sick. The engagement and the monetization has really gotten to people.
Yeah, it really has, and I can't stand that kind of stuff where it's just people constantly need to just show their ass and do dumb shit for clout.
Yeah, start fights for clout, and you're like, realize while they're trying to suck you in, you're like, oh, this is just a fight for, like, they'll call you out in spaces so you could go in there, and then they farm content off you. It's crazy. People are crazy on that app. Crazy. Yeah. Monetizing it was the worst move ever.
Yeah, like I see. And I'm not above this, but like I see people that will say the hard R or something like that. And like, I don't call people that. Like we do the N tower just to like fuck with people. But like, I would never, I see some people saying like, oh, you're this, you're that. I'm like, if you wouldn't say that to a person's face, then why are you saying that online? Like, let's be real here. Like you would probably get your ass whooped. And I'm not saying you deserve it, but I'm just saying like, if you would not say the shit that you're saying online to somebody's face, you should probably just sit down and shut the fuck up.
Well, I mean, I don't say the word because I don't like the word.
Yeah.
I think I find racial slurs to be kind of trashy. Like, I don't really like the K word, the N word, even like spick. Like, I don't like any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. I really find it very, I feel like I'm degrading myself when I start using that language. So that's my issue with it. I understand why people use it for the shock value, but they have to understand that what they're doing is taking the shock value away, taking all of the value away from the word. So right now we have this whole rash of engagement farmers using the N word, which I don't.
Yeah,
it's fine if they were furthering the conversation along in the sense of why they're using the word.
Yeah,
it's just about the I'm yelling the word. I'm letting you know that I hate you, that I'm tired of black people, and that's it. And I'm going to engagement farm off that. They're not saying like I'm tired of black people and this is why. And this is how we should move forward, or this is how we should address these issues, or this is how the conversations should be broached. So I'm just like letting this sort of trend kind of die out. I did crash out over the Shiloh Hendricks thing because I was just like, what are you guys doing? Yeah. Like, I don't understand this. Like, we have people whose lives were ruined that still get detained all the time when they're trying to come home from traveling, and they like that lost their job. Some people lost their children. And you're giving $1 million to somebody for saying the N-word on a playground to a child.
Right.
Like, it's just very strange to me. It's something that I'm like, well, I don't want to be a part of that. Like, I don't, that tells me like where we are right now.
Yeah. I mean, I guess my only pushback, and maybe it's not even necessarily pushback, but I think it was kind of like the cancel culture coming to like a halt where people are like, we're not going to let you shut us down for a word. Now, where I agree with you is like, this isn't good behavior that we should be encouraging, because like, if you're in that situation, you remove yourself from that situation, because, you know, even if the kid was stealing, he shouldn't have been stealing, but like, how would you think that's an appropriate response to talk to a kid that way? And once again, if there's a kid in a park being an asshole, then just leave. Don't like,
or just ask him where his parents are.
Right. Like, there's so many different ways
to go parents. Like, yeah. I don't know the whole situation. I don't really care, but I don't scream that word in public around other people's kids. Like, if I was in the park and my kid was there, not involved in the situation, and there's this woman screaming the N-word, I would have been like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, my kid doesn't need to hear like you having a crash out in the public place. Calm down. Like, over a diaper bag and a child. It's very bizarre.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And like, this kind of back to the point of like engagement farming, he's just like, we're incentivizing this culture of people just behaving like complete and total fucking morons and then paying them to do it. It's like, okay, well, this is going to have like the exact opposite. Dave Portnoy, for example, I'm sure you probably saw
good
some of this.
Where God, it's just like, yes, horrible.
Somebody said fuck Jews on a piece of paper or something like that. And it's like, all right, it's funny, sure, but like, you know, Dave Portnoy going on to his millions of followers, a multi-day long Spurg fest saying how he's going to send somebody to Auschwitz on an all paid trip. Like, do you really think this is going to have the exact, you know, reaction that you wanted? You're offering to send somebody on a vacation to Germany. And like, granted, I know what the purpose of it is, but like, you really think this is like furthering your cause? Like, you were doing everything to make sure that more people end up on the side of people who are just going to say fuck Jews just to piss people off. And like, I don't like any of that stuff. Like, we need to have a serious conversation about funding Israel and about anti-Semitism, right? Quote unquote. Like, this isn't really a big concern, but you know, it's a concern because we're being punished for, you know, saying we shouldn't fund Israel. Like, now they say that's anti-Semitism. We need to have a conversation about this. But when you say fuck Jews and then you have somebody that spurgs out about it like this, you're doing nothing to help people like us that are saying like, we need to have a more humble foreign policy, return to like what Ron Paul and Pat Buchanan said, isolationism and respect.
Well, again, it circles back to that social Darwinistic. Like, there's this one post that was like, you scammed me. And it was like, shame on me. No, shame on you. And it's like, that's how we operate right now. That's, if I scam you, it's shame on you. If I say N-word to you and I engagement farm off of it, shame on you. I'm winning in the social Darwin game. So that's what, like, we've incentivized being mean to each other for content. I mean, what are they called? I forget what they call it. Nuisance streamers are like a norm. American nuisance streamers are like a norm.
I never heard of this.
In other countries where they go and they just bother the locals. And we've incentivized this because we like to see people's reaction when they're viscerally uncomfortable, viscerally, visually, or like obviously offended. We like that. That's very sadistic when you think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so,
I mean, gross. That's what the question that I asked last night. People were like trying to have this conversation with me about why can't I say the N-word? And I'm like, you know, not everything belongs to you, and that's okay. And then we kind of went back and forth a little bit more. And I said, okay, but at the end of the day, why do you want to hurt people like that?
Yeah.
Like, you're literally fighting for the ability to use a word that's off limits because of the horrible historical connotations and the fact that it hurts and offends people. Whether you think that them being hurt or offended is okay is a whole nother story. But why do you want to hurt people? You want to hurt them.
Yeah.
Very strange.
I don't like this whole... And like the contrarian reflex, I know probably my more right-wing followers are going to get upset with me when I say this, but like, you know, this whole bigotry thing where just people are like, oh, I'm being bigoted because this hurts, this pisses off the right people. Right. Like, I've always hated that contrarian reflex.
It's so cringe.
Yeah. Like, can't you just be principled or like have something you believe in? Like, I treat all people well because like I'm a people's person. I'm a very social person. I'm a musician. I'm a podcaster. So I like talking to people, I like meeting new people. I don't have hate in my heart for anybody. Like, I joke about, you know, the whole India Pakistan war where I'm like, oh, I'm signed with Pakistan because I hate Indian culture. But like, I generally hope everybody, you know, everything works out for peace and people are okay. But like, it's just like this, the left under Obama had created this whole culture of just like, oh, you're a bigot for this, right, for that. And then like, oh, you know, you're not a real man if you don't want to date trans women or something like that. It's like, well, when you push people that far, eventually
the pendulum does swing. Yes. Right.
Yeah. People are going to be like, oh, no, I'm a bigot and I'm a Nazi because fuck you. Right. And like, I just think it's so childish. Like, why can't we just act like fucking adults?
I get it though. I mean, I get it in the interim. I mean, I understand it. I think that's important, but, and then it's okay to also call it out and just say like, okay, this is cringe and gay. Like, this is cringe. Like saying the N-word to get famous is very cringe and very weird, especially when you're not offering any further analysis of it. That's kind of what bothers me the most, is like this very shock value. But then I don't know if you saw, a lady in China went up to a black person and said the N-word, and she was promptly arrested and forced to apologize. So it just shows you the very cultural difference between the United States and China. And I'm not talking about it in an authoritarian way. We have our own authoritarian things, whether you think, I mean, we can't criticize Israel without getting sent home packing. So her saying the N-word wasn't disciplined because the state wants control over the things that they say. She was disciplined because exactly what I said. Because of the social cohesion, she's a detriment to the social cohesion and the well-being of the people that she was approached. That's why she was arrested and forced to apologize. Not to shame her, but to fix the actual crack that she made. That's why China functions better, because they are ideally like that. That hurting one person is so important to the social fabric and the societal like sustainment of the country that it's important to make them apologize and rectify it and make people understand that this sort of behavior isn't tolerated. Why? Because they see us and they don't want to be like this. So we have America who raises $1 million for her. When I asked all of my friends, I know a lot of people that gave her money. I said, why did you give them money? To piss off the blacks. And I was like, are they pissed? And like, and they're like, I'm like, well, how do they feel? Are they mad? Yeah. And then they would show me like a TikTok video. I'm like, oh, they're also engagement farming off of it. You know, like, are they actually mad? Like, where's the conversation? And so China, their reaction to it, I think, is quite refreshing. I mean, I understand it, but I don't know. So very interesting.
Yeah, it's like a race to the bottom, and it's
that's what we were talking about today. I was like, it's a literal race to the bottom to see. So we were talking about Kanye, and I was like, it's, I don't, whether you believe everything that he says, I don't.
He's entertaining. That's the way I look at it.
But it's still a race to the bottom. He's like, how many horrible things can I say, and how long are they going to let me get away with it before they actually make me stop?
Right.
So he's really doing it that way, and you know, I have people try to rationalize it to me, but it's still a race to the bottom. He's leading the pack, but there's a lot of degenerates in his wake that are following him.
It's they've really incentivized that behavior, because like you said, it's basically, oh, well, we're going to pay you to be this way. And when you act like an asshole, you get more attention. And, you know, I'm glad at least it seems like you and I kind of like look at that and be like, yeah, I'm not going to be a part of it. I think about this all the time. Like, yeah, if I put on a Trump hat right now and then said, oh, fuck seed oils, Trump's the greatest, and just towed the MAGA line, I could have so many more followers. But, you know, I'm a Ron Paul guy, right? Non-interventionism. Yes, exactly. Yeah, he's truly great. Oh, yeah, that's right. I forgot. Dan McAdams. Yeah, Dan McAdams had gave you a little bit of a buffing out on the last Liberty Report yesterday. I was listening to it yesterday morning, and he had mentioned, I think they're reading an article or something from you guys, but
really?
Yes.
Oh, I'll have to go look.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a good friend of mine.
I love him. Daniel McAdams. He's great.
Yeah. He's truly great. Well, you know, we've been going for about an hour and 15. I know you said you had to cut off at about an hour and a half. So let's kind of wrap up on what kind of gives you hope, because now we're seeming to go back up talking about people we mutually like. So yeah, Sarah, what gives you hope for the future?
I actually, I said this before he even got elected, that I didn't vote. I was in Russia for the election on purpose, but I wanted him to get elected because I think he's better for multipolarity. And he's shown me that he is, all jokes aside, while it's, you know, there's some sarcasm to that, he's accelerating us getting there. And that's something that I'm happy with. So I'm hopeful for that. I think there will be a lot of growing pains for Americans, and it will suck. But this is nothing that other countries haven't gone through multiple times, either because of us or on the peripheral. So it's something that we're going to survive and we're going to come out on the other way. But what I'd really like to see is like a lesser social discord, more social cohesion and more coalition building. But I'm hopeful for the parade on Friday and all of the meetings coming out from the world leaders for that. I'm hopeful for all of that. And I'm hopeful that Trump will have no other choice but to see the light and to kind of get into the mix with everyone else and on board with the United States is not the hegemon anymore. And that multipolarity is coming and we can all live together, not in a gay Teletubby way, but in a sovereign, strong and cohesive, happy way.
Yeah, I had a friend talk about basically like he thought the Monroe Doctrine kind of deal was the right way to go. And now I don't necessarily fully agree with that, but kind of like against the Mearsheimer case where he says like we should limit China's influence over in their region. It's like, no, like, first of all, we can't contain China. And why would we? Like, the U.S. doesn't have the capability to do that. Like, you could try to cause discord, you know, amongst their neighbors. And like, we do have, you know, now probably the largest arms build up since World War II, strictly focused at China and Russia. But like, how are we going to limit their influence in the region? But to your point, basically like, yeah, the U.S. should have influence kind of in our sphere over here. We leave Russia alone. We leave China alone. They have influences in their spheres. We're all friendly. We could trade, but, you know, we respect each other's sovereignty. I think that's the best way to go, because the only other way really is basically, yeah, we have, you know, China has 500 nukes. Who knows how many the U.S. has? Russia has thousands. And we just can't have that, you know, these three countries be in conflict. It just cannot happen.
Yeah, I 100% agree. The age of hegemony is over, and it's time to respect the regional hegemony of the superpowers. And we need to really, once we do that, we'll be fine.
Yeah, I completely agree. Well, Sarah, this was an absolutely fantastic conversation. I really, really enjoyed it. Why don't you let everybody know where they could find you, support you, and all that good stuff? I have a couple links down below, but anywhere you want people to go.
Visit us at www.ddgeopolitics.com. We have merch. Shipping is free. There's no tariffs or taxes. Also, try to engage with the Twitter account if you can, because it's shadow banned, because we don't buy bots. We should start, though. We should just jump on the bot bandwagon.
Yeah, I watch the Nick Fuentes tweets and I see how many likes he gets right away. I'm like, yeah, there's no way there's.
Oh, no, those are probably Groypers. You have no idea. Those people are so dedicated. I have to respect it. I really do. They have the biggest online presence and they work. But I'm sure there's bots mixed in. A lot of times you get botted and you don't even know it.
Yeah.
So that can happen too. But yeah, that's mostly just Groyper dedication.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, I haven't seen any of the ass and bio bots lately. I think those are
good. Good. Yeah, they're mostly gone. Now we're dealing with the stock trader bots. We'll get through it.
We'll be fine. So I really appreciate your time today. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I will be live tomorrow, same time, 7 p.m. Eastern with Marcel Dumas. And until next time, everybody, take care.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.